once again to that big musty movie palace of your mind we call the Popcorn Cathedral, located at the junction of film, faith, and fantasy. I'm your host, Jack Bennett, here with my dad, Rod Bennett, author of Four Witnesses, The Apostasy That Wasn't, The Christus Experiment, and other noted Christian books. This week we're continuing our series on Indiana Jones, wondering how it is he manages to get converted from skepticism in every episode, yet still winds up right back on square one as a scoffer whenever the next chapter begins. Dad's told me he's calling this one Raiders of the Electrical Ark, so I'm hyped for this one. I've been keeping myself spoiler-free, I've not heard any of it, so I am a live reaction here.
Well, this should be fun. I think I've got some material. No matter how much you've read about Indiana Jones, I think I've got some stuff here you may not have heard before. This should be pretty entertaining for everybody.
I'm pretty psyched.
Also, just want to make a nice shout out to all of you who've been downloading our episodes and all of you who've joined our Popcorn Cathedral Facebook group.
Definitely. We're happy to have the support.
Yeah. And
hope you guys will have fun.
Looking forward to interacting with you guys in the days to come. Well, as Jack has told you, I'm calling this one Raiders of the Electrical Ark. And yes, you are allowed to use ark in two different senses.
Interesting.
I'd like to focus in this chapter, basically in this episode, I'd like to turn our focus from a while from the raider to the ark.
Yeah.
And I think this will go a long way towards illuminating Indy's confused state of mind. If not that of the filmmakers as well. And it should give us a little more insight into the topic at hand. I've been reading books about the making of Raiders for probably close on to 40 years now.
About as long as it's been since the
movie's come out. That's right, I guess.
We're coming up on the 40th anniversary,
21
the 40th anniversary. Yeah, 81 to 21.
Crazy,
yeah.
Hard to think. It still seems new to me.
It's a classic, no doubt. It's an ageless
but
classic.
That's one of the reasons we picked it. We figured people old and young would enjoy parsing all this out with us. So yeah. We've got a lot to talk about tonight. So without any further ado, Jack's just going to be the audience tonight because he doesn't know any of this stuff.
Yep, I'm ready. I'm a completely fresh reaction here.
All right, here we go. Remember how in last episode we talked about how George Lucas got his wonderful MacGuffin from fellow Bay Area filmmaker Philip Kaufman. George took Indy to Phil in 1974, very early on. And here's how Phil in one of the transcripts recaps the thing. He says, George Lucas and I sat down to write a story. I had the idea of the Lost Ark. George had the idea of the Indiana Jones character. We talked for about 6 weeks, and then I got an offer to do another movie. About 4 years later, I got a call from George saying that he and Spielberg talked about the project on a beach in Hawaii, and would I mind if Steven did it? And I said, fine, and that's what happened. I didn't want to write the screenplay, and they brought on board Lawrence Kasdan. I sat with Larry Kasdan and we talked about it, and then I didn't really have anything else to do with it after that. Well, most film buffs, I think, have heard this story, but I don't think many of you realize exactly what version of the Ark Phil Kaufman introduced to Lucas. Yes, Phil brought in the Ark of the Covenant, but it's not much like the version that wound up in the finished movie. Much less like the ark that's in the Bible. And where he did get it and in what form is going to make this story much nuttier than you may have been expecting, but also more interesting spiritually as well. So
this is where we're going to make a hard left right here. We've been setting you guys up until now, but this is where we're going to get to the wacky stuff.
Well, the interview with Larry Kasdan that Phil Kaufman mentioned took place right after the big 5-day story marathon that we went over in the last episode. George sent Larry to interview Phil Kaufman and to get the actual details about the ARC story that George had largely forgotten. They also sent a professional Hollywood researcher along named Deborah Fine, and they asked her in between to do some independent research on the topic. Screenwriter Frank Darabont used to call Ms. Fine the godfather of research. And she actually did do work on Godfather Part II for George's friend, Francis Coppola.
Right, awesome.
But like the story transcripts, the notes from this 1978 meeting are still preserved. We can refer to them today, and that's where a lot of this comes from. Interestingly, this interview constitutes Phil Kaufman's final input into Raiders of the Lost Ark. But he still got, along with George Lucas, the story credit on the finished movie. And not just that, he still has one on every single Indiana Jones property ever since then.
Right.
Sequels, comic books, video games, everything. So this was a nice day's work for Phil.
Pretty good.
Well, let's read a little of this interview. Phil starts off, Deborah is calling to mind the project, and he remembers it. He says, yeah, Carmen Miranda, seaplanes, kind of a Middle Eastern adventure based around a similar idea to that book, The Spear of Destiny, where the Nazis were into mystical cults and so forth. Okay, the book that Kaufman is mentioning here came out in 1973, only a year or so before he shared his ideas with George. So it's a pretty good bet that this book was the real genesis of Raiders, at least as far as the Lost Ark angle goes. The full title of this book, by the way, is The Spear of Destiny, The Occult Power Behind the Spear Which Pierced the Side of Christ. So, and the author of the book was a guy named Trevor Ravenscroft.
Pretty good,
so,
definitely, yeah.
Yes, the fact that Indy's old mentor in Raiders, the guy that's the expert on the staff of Ra.
Professor Ravenwood,
that's
a similar
right.
name.
Yes,
yeah,
and
yeah.
That's probably not a
pretty
coincidence.
Good.
So, and we know this because the idea behind this book actually made it into Larry Kasdan's first draft of the Raiders script, more or less intact. It's the scene where the government men come to visit Indy, and I'll read you a section of it. One of the government men says, have you ever heard of the Spear of Longinus? And Indy says, it's supposed to have pierced the side of Christ on the cross. And the government man says, right, it's sometimes called the Spear of Destiny. The legend is that the man who controls it controls the destiny of the world. Right now it's on display in the Habsburg Museum in Vienna. Hitler has gone to Vienna 5 times to view it, and those are just the visits we know about. Indy says, I've been to the Smithsonian a few times. That doesn't make me obsessed. And the government man says, you're right, but we've had reliable intelligence, and I must tell you, this is top secret, that within a year, Hitler will invade and annex Austria. Our source tells us that one of his primary motivations is to take possession of the Spear of Destiny. And Indy says, what's this got to do with me? All right, so from here, the government men go on to tell Indy pretty much the secret, to tell him about the secret dig at Tanis. So, and looking for the Ark. It's pretty much the same scene that's in the finished movie.
With the spear
point.
Instead
yeah.
of the Ark. At
well,
this stage,
he switches over and starts talking about the Ark, and you'll see.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. Partway through the scene, different than in the finished movie, Indy takes him to see an older archaeologist on staff at the university, a man named Stansbury. And he from reading it, I can say he may be the origin of the John Hurt Oxley character in the much later Crystal Skull movie. But anyway, here's part of Stansbury's dialogue. The spear has certain ephemeral beliefs attached to it, none of them proven. But the Ark, that's a different story. That's real power. And one of the government men says, Hitler's just mad enough to believe that. Stansbury comes back. Yes, if one must be mad to believe, I don't know about that. But there's one other thing Hitler undoubtedly believes about the Ark. It's said that the Lost Ark will be recovered at the time of the coming of the true Messiah.
Interesting.
All of this from the first draft screenplay, dated 1978, summer of 78. So, this scene seems to me to illustrate Kaufman's own way of discovering the ideas for the movie. the real-life Spear story, which actually does have some root in history, becomes the lead-in to a similar story about the Ark of the Covenant, which was never actually connected with the Nazis before. Phil Kaufman made that connection, and thus his story credit.
Sure, yeah.
Let me read a little more about what Phil says in the talk with Deborah Fine. She says, It was a thing that I've been thinking about for maybe 20 years since a doctor, my mononucleosis doctor when I was in college, a famous blood specialist, told me he'd written a book about it with another doctor. It was an article on the Ark of the Covenant and how he felt it provided a means of communication with some other extraterrestrial or godlike being or whatever. It was really an elaborate radio setup. It contained silk curtains and veils and other things. I've forgotten. It's all in the Bible, Leviticus. Exodus, the second book of the Bible, or whatever, the beginning of Leviticus or something. A good part of that section of the Bible is the detailing of the actual Ark of the Covenant itself, and all of the, you know, wood and how much, and gold cherubim, and there were other components in there. And he, the doctor, was saying that when the gold was rubbed in a certain way, and the silk and so forth, you have the ability to receive radio waves.
Jones, don't you realize what the Ark is?
Right. Well, what's he talking about here? Well, he's right that Exodus chapters 25 through 29 really is little else but an extraordinarily detailed set of instructions for the making of the Ark and the tabernacle. The tabernacle was the big top style circus tent that it was going to be traveling with, the sort of movable temple for the Hebrews to worship in during the Exodus. And then the whole list gets repeated again in chapters 37 through 39 when the thing actually gets built. So he's not wrong in saying that there's an awful lot about precisely how to build the Ark in here. Let's go back to Phil now. The Levites were the only ones who could go in to where it was, and they would have to take their shoes off. Like, you have to be careful when you walk across the rug with your shoes off. But there's a whole electrical charge. The Holy of Holies was, in fact, a means of communicating with some other being, that it was a primitive or maybe a highly elaborate radio wave that was on the right sensitivity for this kind of communication. And in fact, when they used to go into battle, there was this cloud that always hovered over the Ark. And when they took it, they were always victorious. They never lost whenever they carried it into battle. Well, people have looked for this book that was supposedly written by Phil's mono doctor, and they've never turned anything up. You may have noticed that he does call it an article at one point, though.
Yeah.
So maybe it's not really an actual book we're looking for. Could just be a short recap of previous electrical arc theories, which we're going to talk about next. So, anyhow, the search continues for the book written by Phil's mono doctor.
Huh.
Phil got over mononucleosis, by the way, so good news.
Yeah, good news. Good news.
So,
yeah.
Anyhow, another popular World of the Unexplained type book that came out just about the same time as The Spear of Destiny.
A lot of people will recognize this one, remember it if you're around back then.
Made a much bigger splash than The Spear of Destiny did. And by the way, the 70s, for if you weren't around for this, were the kind of the golden age for the unexplained fad. Bigfoot, UFOs.
Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of.
That's right. A lot of people may remember that.
Yeah.
And Bermuda Triangle, that sort of thing. All really,
Stonehenge, Easter Island heads, that kind
really
of thing.
Big in the 70s. And anyway, the book that I'm talking about right now was a book called Chariots of the Gods. And it was written in 1968 by a Swiss named Eric von Däniken. It involves the hypothesis that all the technologies and religions of ancient civilizations were actually given to them by ancient astronauts who got mistaken for gods. Some of you have probably heard this idea before.
I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens.
Right. So Chariots of the Gods was one of the most popular of these things. It was made into a film that came out in 1972, and it was shown on network TV a year or so after that, and it got huge ratings. Like I said, the time was right. And of course, as Jack alluded to there, a lot of you have probably seen the more recent revamp on TV, the Ancient Alien show. So anyway, I'm going to provide a link to Chariots of the Gods on the Popcorn Cathedral Facebook page because the whole movie is available. I'm going to give you just the one section of this movie that talks about the Ark, and it's not very long, 5 minutes at the most. And I'm just going to read this section of it to you. Mount Horeb in the Sinai Range rises more than 6,500 feet above sea level. Here, Moses received the Ten Commandments. Here also, the Lord gave him the blueprints for the Ark of the Covenant. The Lord was extremely precise about the building of the Ark. He warned that no one should come near the structure. It represented a mortal danger. And though he himself would speak to Moses from the covering plate, he could not be seen. Moses was even to provide special shoes and clothing to protect his workmen, shoes and clothing that would insulate them properly. If we were to build a replica of the Ark today, according to Moses' instructions, we would have a condenser charged with several hundred volts. One side of the plates carrying a negative charge, the other a positive one. The Bible says the Ark bristled with sparks and bright flashes, as in these old paintings. Indeed, when Moses had erected the Ark, the Lord would speak to him through it. Could the gold sheath have been a form of loudspeaker, producing the Lord's voice from afar? In 1961, a group of Minnesota college students took Moses seriously enough to construct an ark according to his directions. Their instructor, however, had to have the model destroyed because of the dangerously high electrical charge it developed. Okay, that's the ark section from Chariots of the Gods. Well, obviously, this is not the Ark of the Covenant as people of faith understand it. And since our listeners don't know us very well yet, Jack, let's go ahead and say right out that it's not the version we believe in
either. It's not the version we believe in either, definitely.
Both of us are Orthodox believing Christians, but it is definitely the version that Phil Kaufman brought to George Lucas in 1974. And let me give you a few illustrations.
The one
that
started the whole kerfuffle in the first place.
Yes. A few more excerpts from that story conference transcript that we read so much of last week. George says, it's one of these in search of things. And then to Spielberg, you've been describing this to people as a science fiction film, which is good. Steven comes back and says, I have not. George says, it's in Rolling Stone. Now, what this debate between the two of them was, I don't know. I haven't read the Rolling Stone article in question. Anyway, back to George. Anyway, the idea is you explain the Ark and the power it held and the fact that they've been searching. There's a history to it. And this, again, is where the research is going to come in. Phil knew more about this than I did, and his notes are very sketchy. This is the part he laid out. I didn't quite understand it all, but I do have information on it. It's actually very easy to follow. The real theory about the Ark is that if you take this Ark and put it in this conformation with these tents, you could talk to God in it. It's like a radio transmitter. That's the real legend. That's what they used to do. The Israelis used to set up these tents, and they would talk to God, and God would tell them what to do. And then they would march with it in front of their army. The other armies would be destroyed. Our idea was that there must actually be some kind of super high-powered radio from one of Eric von Däniken's flying saucers. The fact that it's electrical charges makes it vaguely believable. We have to get descriptions of what it looks like, but supposedly it's like a big trunk. It's like a car generator that you crank and it goes. When they opened it up, you had that sense of some kind of kinetic generator, which creates a tremendous amount of static electricity. And there are all these religious trappings and interesting mysteries and occult stuff, but at the same time, it's something that people can carry around. And when they open it at the end, there's of our story, there's this lightning bolt or electrical charge, and the whole thing becomes like kinetic energy with lightning arcs, like a lightning rod. It attracts static electricity. Okay.
Interesting. Now, last bit.
Now, Larry Kasdan questioned Phil Kaufman about his sources in the later interview with Deborah Fine. Here's what Larry says. "So you don't remember where the article is that this doctor wrote?" And Phil says, "I wouldn't know. I mean, it would be, let's see, somewhere around 1955. Deborah chimes in and says, "Because I got everything I could find on the subject." Larry says, "Nothing by a blood specialist?" Deborah says, "Nothing by a blood specialist. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Phil says, "Well, you found that thing where von Däniken mentioned something." Larry says, "Yeah, he covers it in about 2 pages, briefly, real briefly." Phil says, "Yeah, but that's the same kind of thing. I was surprised to see that. I'm sure some of these articles, whenever somebody writes anything somewhat occult, all the occultists run out and say, 'Hey, did you hear the latest thing?'" And Deborah says, "I did find reference to the whole electrical charge business and all these theories in another article, but I didn't find the one you mentioned." Phil says, "I mean, I forgot all the details. Other than that, I don't know." So Larry says, "So basically it was your doctor and his article and von Däniken and the Bible and nothing else that we know anything about." And that's pretty much it. Okay. So, where does all this stuff come from? Where did von Däniken get it? Well, all I can say at this point is, you'd be surprised. let me give you a little bit of a sneak preview. It involves Sir Isaac Newton, Napoleon Bonaparte, Sigmund Freud, and H.P. Lovecraft.
And?
Well, I'm saving that for another time.
Okay,
I told Jack another name on the list, but we'll save that.
We'll save this one. So. Quite a crowd we've got built up. Yes. So far, though.
And I'm going to lead you on a pretty merry chase here. In fact, probably the rest of this episode we'll be trying to track this down, but I promise it's going to be worth it when we get to the end. So let's go back a ways. I'll try to make a very long short story as short as possible here. In fact, to begin with, the early parts of what I'm about to tell you, actually, I owe a hat tip to Dr. Scott Hahn for, because he turned me on to a book called Moses the Egyptian by a very respected Egyptologist called Dr. Jan Osman. And it wasn't for this purpose. It was part of the research for the book that he and I are collaborating on. But I saw right away that there was a connection here. So anyway, there's basically a very old tradition of reinventing Moses that goes all the way back to the time of Moses himself. Of necessity, I suppose. I mean, if you're not willing to bow the knee to Moses as God, but you're too honest to just brazen the thing out as a complete fable, you know, there never was any Moses or any ark, even though Moses is a central founder in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, 3/5 of the world's population, in other words. Then if you can't do that, then you're going to have to offer some kind of alternative reading instead. As you may recall from the Bible, Pharaoh himself dealt with Moses at first as a magician with actual powers like his own court magicians.
Yeah, the magicians. Yeah, right. He treats Moses like a...
Right, and Moses...
A conjurer of cheap tricks, as Gandalf would say.
Maybe so, yeah. But that starts with Pharaoh. So right back from day one, alternative explanations for Moses are an old tradition. Well, they've turned up ever since then, and we're going to go over a few of them. Excuse me. Some of these non-biblical Moseses are hostile accounts. Some of them are just faithless. And some of them actually try to appropriate Moses for themselves. So here we go. The first of these, the first earliest surviving extra-biblical account of the Exodus, was composed by a guy named Hecataeus of Abdera. Hecataeus was a skeptical philosopher who wrote A History of Egypt in the 300s BC. And this one may be the most interesting in some ways because it predates the Septuagint. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament that was published around 200 BC. The Septuagint is the way that most of the ancient world, the pagans, became familiar with Moses. But that book, again, the Greek translation that the non-Hebrew world could understand, wasn't published until about 200 BC. So this account is about 100 years before that. Well, in Hecataeus's version, a plague was ravaging Egypt, and the Egyptians interpreted it as a divine punishment for tolerating the presence in Egypt of so many foreigners and the introduction of alien rites and customs like the Hebrews. So because of this, in order to win back the favor of the traditional Egyptian gods, the foreigners were expelled. And according to Hecataeus, some of them, under the leadership of, quote, Cadmos and Danaos, colonized Greece, while others, under the leadership of Moses, colonized Palestine. So in this version, Moses didn't say, let my people go. Pharaoh told Moses, as we'd say around here in the hills, yuns will have to get.
So yeah, more or less, yeah.
Yes. So there's so much for Hecataeus. The next stop on this itinerary is a man named Strabo. Strabo was a Greek philosopher, a Greek geographer, who lived about the same time as Julius Caesar. I'm reading now this section from an encyclopedia. According to Strabo, an Egyptian priest named Moses, who rejected Egyptian polytheism, decided to found a new religion and emigrated with his followers into Palestine. His new religion consisted only of the recognition of the one divine being, whom no image can represent, quote, which encompasses us all, including earth and sea, that which we call the heavens, the world, and the essence of things. This one thing only is God. So a kind of a pantheistic monotheism, I guess. So, and according to Strabo, the only way to approach this God is to live in virtue and justice. So Strabo's Moses imposed no laws other than you shall have no other gods before me. So
interesting.
Now, in this version, later on, the Hebrews deviated from the purity of Moses' doctrine, and they developed superstitious rules about dietary prohibitions and the requirement for circumcision and things like that. So essentially, Strabo's version is an early version of the Great Apostasy Theory.
More or less, yes, yeah.
Right. Well, next we come to Philo, who lived about the same time, during the life of Christ, really, from about 25 BC to 50 AD. Philo was an Egyptian Jew, lived in Alexandria. Philo's testimony is really valuable because he was an expert in three distinct brands of first century wisdom: Jewish, Greek, and ancient Egyptian. The Old Testament tells us only that Moses became, quote, very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, and in the sight of the people. That's from Exodus 11. But there's a fascinating verse in the New Testament that tells us something more. In Acts chapter 7, during the sermon that he preaches just prior to his martyrdom, St. Stephen says, quote, Pharaoh's daughter adopted him and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in his words and deeds. This is Acts 7:21-22. Well, this is interesting. This is a piece of Hebrew tradition. This is not actually in the Pentateuch. So this is an example of a non-biblical tradition that wound up in the Bible sort of late as we went. But anyway, Philo gets his ideas from the very same source, from these unwritten extra-biblical Hebrew traditions. Now, here's Philo's version. As an adopted son in the royal family, Moses was seen for a considerable period as a successor to the throne. And Egyptologists tell us that this would have included all the ins and outs of Egyptian religion and priestcraft, including magic, of the same type that we see the wizards challenging him with in the book of Exodus. Well, Philo says that Moses was initiated into, quote, the symbolic philosophy of the ancient Egyptians. He also gives a detailed account of everything else that was taught, that Moses was taught. And here's a quote. Moses was taught arithmetic, geometry, poetry, and music. Also, teachers from neighboring countries were assigned to teach him Assyrian letters and the Chaldean science of the heavens. This he also acquired from Egyptians, who gave special attention to astrology. So, Philo. It's interesting. If you look at the book of Exodus, just to remind you, Pharaoh's heart isn't softened during the first two plagues, the river of blood and the frogs, because his own court magicians are able to do the same thing.
Interesting.
So the idea that Pharaoh expects a familiarity with the magical arts from Moses, too, isn't really unbiblical.
Hmm.
Now, note, I have to step in with a little bit of a note here. Philo isn't saying that Moses performed his miracles by magic. Philo was a believing Jew, and he accepted the idea that God did the miracles through Moses, that Moses' power came from God alone. So, but later speculators following in Philo's wake weren't so careful. And the next stop along this trail is at a spot called Hermeticism. Another ancient Egyptian called called Hermes Trismegistus is the supposed author of a set of books that we call the Hermetic Corpus. This is a collection of sacred texts that are the basis for a philosophical system called Hermeticism. Now, there's some question as to whether there really was any Hermes, but that's just another subject. It may be that lots of people were involved in writing these books. But even so, the writings are definitely very old, whoever wrote them. They definitely all date from 100 BC at the very latest, probably much earlier than that. And the interesting thing is they were highly respected in antiquity, even by very orthodox Christian writers. Saint Augustine, Saint Cyprian of Carthage, Saint Clement of Alexandria, all of these looked at Hermes as a wise pagan prophet who foresaw the coming of Christianity. In fact, St. Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages believed that Hermes had already deduced the Trinitarian nature of God centuries before the coming of Christ.
Wow.
That's pretty interesting, isn't it?
St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yes. Now, keep in mind, at this point, magic, quote unquote, wasn't exclusively identified with sorcery and other forbidden practices yet. And we'll go into this as we go. In fact, one of the main ideas of Hermeticism is that there are two different types of magic, and they're totally opposite from each other. The Renaissance Hermetic, Pico della Mirandola, defined these two types as goetia, which is black magic, that depends upon an alliance with demons and is always wrong, and theurgy, which is supposed to be God-based and relies on invoking the aid of angels. Okay? Now, let me step in for a second and say I'm not saying that I think Hermeticism is okay or not. I'm just giving you the facts right now. That's just another
what they claim.
Another topic for another day. So, but either way, there's no question that many of the early documents explicitly state that Hermes borrowed his ideas from Moses, the Egyptian magician. So, how did we get from Moses, who uses the art to talk to spirits or angels or whatever, how did that turn into Moses, who uses the ark to talk to flying saucers? Well,
the electricity and positive and negative charge and all that.
Hang with me. You're going to have to hang with me a little longer. Now, okay, jump forward to the Renaissance, the late Renaissance. At that point, the concept of magic underwent a more positive reassessment through the development of the concept of magia naturalis, natural magic. This is a term that was developed by two Italian humanists, Marsilio Ficino and Giordano Bruno. And here's a quote from a book on the subject. For them, magia was viewed as an elemental force pervading many natural processes, and thus was fundamentally distinct from the mainstream Christian idea of demonic magic. End quote. Well, this concept of natural magic, it really caught fire in European culture at that time during the 14th and 15th centuries. At this point, magic had begun to evolve into science. Cornelius Agrippa, whom you Potterheads out there may have on one of your famous witches and wizards cards.
Yeah.
Cornelius Agrippa was the greatest of the alchemists, and he definitely believed that Moses was an Egyptian magician. By magician, we mean scientist.
Scientist at this point, yeah.
Agrippa divided magic into three parts: astrology, alchemy, and theurgy. These disciplines eventually developed into what we would today consider the fields of astronomy, chemistry, and psychology. And it's only been widely known for the last 100 years or so, but Sir Isaac Newton was also an alchemist, as well as a student of Hermes Trismegistus. And Newton also believed that Moses had passed down proto-scientific ideas that he obtained from the ancient Egyptians. So, now, okay, from Isaac Newton, it's a pretty short walk to the deists of the 18th century. Deists at that time,
you should explain deism.
Deism,
maybe.
Yeah. If you don't know about deism, it was all the rage in the 1700s. Famous practitioners, Thomas Jefferson, people of that type. Basically, the idea is that we believe in God. We're doubling down, in fact, on our belief in God, but we don't believe in miracles and water turning into wine and all those other things that have. Fables that have stuck to the original idea, like barnacles, if you see what I'm saying. So deism was an attempt to strip all the later accretions.
The clockmaker god, the idea.
Although
of the god
that's been a little overstressed.
Has it maybe? Or?
Many of the deists didn't actually hold to the idea that God couldn't intervene or that he wasn't interested in human affairs.
But one offshoot of deism is the idea of the clockmaker god, the one who made the universe, who created it, designed it, set it into motion, but is just unrelated, impersonal.
Sits back and watches
Watches it go along its own volition.
Right. He's too far above and beyond to.
Not necessarily.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, all deists of this era,
right,
specifically,
exactly.
But might have been overstated a little bit.
These deists of the 18th century liked Strabo's ideas about Moses as the inventor of monotheism, but they weren't so crazy about the magic. So most of the Moses the Egyptian thinking gets diverted off into Moses the deist, Moses the scientist at this point. They like to credit him with being the first monotheist, but they're not so interested in the magic. There's reason to believe at this point that both Rosicrucianism and its stepchild Freemasonry are both based on this idea that Moses was a pure kind of Spinoza-like Unitarian until the Jews came in and messed it all up with their superstitions, the worst of which is Trinitarian Christianity.
Yeah.
So, and in fact, if the Masons aren't they're pretty careful about letting their rituals get out, but people who've studied them say that one of the main ideas is that that their philosophy goes back to Moses, who was actually a Unitarian and a nature worshiper whose beliefs were corrupted by the Jews. So anyhow, this idea led deist writers like Matthew Tindall and John Toland to interpret Moses' miracles as lost Egyptian super science of the type that made the pyramids possible. And Toland bases everything on Strabo. Moses was an Egyptian priest and a deist, powerful in words and deeds, which of course he interprets as natural magic. It's interesting that Acts 7:22 becomes infallible to these guys. You know, Moses, quote, learned all the wisdom of the Egyptian and became mighty in words and deeds, at the very same time that they're dismissing the whole of the Pentateuch as a tissue of fables. So, go figure.
There you go.
Anyhow, the Ark may have been, according to these guys, neither religion nor sorcery, but instead some kind of a super weapon that was based on lost Egyptian scientific wisdom, kind of a Tesla death ray circa, 1000 BC.
Sure.
So, in fact, one of the most prominent Ark hunters today, an Englishman by the name of Graham Hancock, pretty educated guy, pretty well-read fellow, subscribes to the theory. He says, this is a quote from him, "The Ark had possessed genuine powers, but those powers had been neither supernatural nor divine. On the contrary, they must have been the products of human skill and ingenuity." So anyway, well, okay, we're making progress. We're up to the dawn of the 19th century. There seems to be some reason to suspect that this was one of Napoleon Bonaparte's reasons for invading Egypt in 1798. Along with his armies, Napoleon took a team of 150 scientists with him to Egypt, and they put out a document before they left explaining their purposes, quote, "to enlighten the world and to obtain new treasures for science," end quote. So, and this really was a very important event. Essentially, ancient Egypt was discovered during this expedition. I mean, there were rumors coming out of Egypt, but they'd never been studied by anybody. All the tombs and temples at Luxor, the Valley of the Kings, all of this, Napoleon's scientists mapped them all for the first time and measured them out and did architectural drawings, detail, you know. This was a pre-Roman Egypt that was most people knew only from the Bible at the time of Napoleon. So it's never really been established whether Napoleon was a Mason or not, but certainly most of his staff members were. But the Freemasons were definitely the main popularizers of Egyptomania during this era. They may well have inspired the idea that lost scientific techniques might be found in Egypt, including new weapons for conquest. So, and pyramidology also seems to have been born out of this expedition. This is the idea that the pyramids can only have been built by advanced methods that have been lost to later ages. Egyptian super science, basically. So, perhaps natural magic.
Yeah.
So, people my age may remember pyramid power, another one of those 70s unexplained fads. Sleeping under a pyramid slows aging, and, it's just on and on. There was a lot of it at the time. So, anyway. Okay, now, kind of a sprint towards the finish line here. 19th and early 20th century Europe was big into machines, not so much into Jews. So the Ark, as an example of lost super science, with Moses as an Egyptian rather than a Hebrew, began to be pretty appealing to some people. Moses, the first monotheist, got more and more popular. It got to Germany by way of Goethe and Schiller. Schiller, their national poet. In fact, this is trippy. Mozart, an Austrian, he wrote a series of Masonic hymns based on the idea of Moses, the first monotheist. Moses the Egyptian, basically. Now, this here is where Freud, now that we're in Germany, Greater Germany, Austria.
The early 20th century.
This is where Freud comes in. Freud's last book which was written in 1939, is called Moses and Monotheism. And Freud was ethnically Jewish, but he really hated the Jewish religion. You know, Moses and Monotheism posits the idea that the original Moses, and this is crazy, listen carefully, this is Freud's book. This book posits the idea that the original Moses was an Egyptian prince who discovered the true deistic type of God and tried to force it on his polytheistic countrymen. After a while, a rebellion grew up, and Moses got himself murdered by his own people. In time, his memory got mixed up with that of a Midianite chieftain who lived several generations afterward. And some of you may remember that Moses in the Bible does marry a Midianite girl, and her father adopts him into the tribe. But in Freud's version, this second Moses worshipped a tribal deity he called Yahweh, which Freud describes as, quote, an uncanny, bloodthirsty demon who wanders at night and shuns daylight.
Wow.
So, Freud attributes all of the true and perfect aspects of religion to Moses the Egyptian. All of the imperfections of the biblical law.
Imperfections, as he would describe them.
Yes. He attributes to Moses the Midianite, that is, Moses the Semite. Now, and some of you may recognize this as a twist on the ancient heresy of Marcionism, which is actually what Scott Hahn and I are writing about and how I got interested in all of this. So, but at any rate, probably those of you who know a little bit about Freud would know that this idea is very congenial to his way of thinking. He was always very interested in people who want to murder their fathers.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's be careful, though. I'm not saying that Freud was a Nazi or even consciously anti-Semitic. But it is true, it is a fact, that his friends were so worried about this book that they urged him not to publish it. 1939, this is right before World War II started. And his friends thought that Freud's idea of the nasty Jewish Moses who took over for the enlightened Gentile Moses provided too much cover for the Nazis. You know, the Nazis were always looking for ways to, they were already at this point looking for ways to undermine the central role that the Bible has played in European culture. The Bible, the entirety of which, by the way, both Old and New Testament, was written by Jews. So, well, at this point, let's go back to Phil Kaufman for just a minute, and let's watch while Deborah Fine hesitantly shares something that she's turned up along the way. She says, the interesting thing I found is that the bulk of the sources are in German. And that just might be an incredible coincidence. And because all of biblical research, it's not really a Nazi kind of thing. It's just that most of the articles in these books are in German. And Phil Kaufman comes in, says, well, the mystical thing wasn't necessarily a Nazi thing. It's just that they picked up on that so much. You know, it's one of the strange things about this is you can get so highly involved in mysticism or the occult that somehow conventional morality no longer has any meaning. And you can even get your head into a Charles Manson kind of place where your whole group is babbling seemingly incoherently, but they actually have a little unified occult viewpoint they're talking, which, you know, allows them to transcend morality. This is still Phil Kaufman. We've always approached the Nazis on a political level, and in fact, they were approaching things on another kind of Wagnerian mystical level. We tend to explain Hitler away in terms of just a madman, but in fact, the Germans, with all their cults of the golden whatever it was, the golden rule or something, they were all looking all over the world for ways of capturing the mystical powers of the earth. Well, what Phil's looking for here with the Golden Rule is he's looking for the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And yes, that's Hermetic in the sense of Hermes Trismegistus. While some Europeans liked Moses wasn't really a Jew, best. Others were still holding out for Moses the magician. And the Golden Dawn was an organization devoted to the study and practice of the occult, metaphysics, paranormal activities during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It's recognized as the forerunner of today's modern Wicca. It was founded in England by three Freemasons and a Rosicrucian. Its hierarchy and its initiation, in fact, are nearly identical to Masonic lodges. Now, okay, this could really get us off track at this point. Just too many nutty esoteric links in all of this, so I'm going to cut it short by oversimplifying a little bit. Basically, this Golden Dawn fraternity set off a whole mid-century craze for natural magic societies and explanations. A large majority of these used Egyptian motifs, a fad that was only accelerated by the media craze surrounding the discovery of King Tut's tomb in 1922. You know, the Shriners are an example. That's sort of an offshoot of masonry with a lot of Egyptian trappings.
Yeah.
Germany, especially in the early to mid 20th century, was absolutely in the thrall of conspiracy theories. In fact, Willy Ley, who was a German rocket engineer who immigrated to the United States in, I think, 37 to escape from Hitlerism, he published an article after the war called Pseudoscience in Nazi Land, where he wrote his opinion that the high popularity of irrational convictions in Germany in the 20s and the 30s explained how it is that National Socialism could have fallen on any kind of fertile ground. There was just already way too much obsession with conspiracy theories. Well, another one of these offshoots does require some mentioning, and that is the Thule Society. This Thule is T-H-U-L-E, like the city in Greenland. The Thule Society was a German occultist group that was founded in Munich right after World War I, named after a mythical northern country in Greek legends. This Thule Society is notable today mainly because it was the organization that sponsored the original German Workers' Party, and that was the party that was later reorganized by Adolf Hitler into the National Socialist German Workers' Party, or the Nazis. Rudolf Hess, Alfred Rosenberg, Hans Frank, Julius Lehmann, and Heinrich Himmler were all associated with the Thule Society in one way or another. Believe it or not, the thing started as a Holy Grail study group with some overlap to Rosicrucianism. 1918. And later on, it became focused on quasi-magical theories about racial purity. Well, in 1918, this Thule Society bought a local weekly newspaper called the Munich Observer. And this paper, eventually under their leadership, evolved into the Völkischer Beobachter, which is the Folk Nationalist Observer, which some of you may recognize became the main Nazi newspaper later on. Pravda for Nazis, basically. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, as we'll see next week, a lot of Hitler's obsession with the occult has been, at the very least, grotesquely overstated. There's no evidence, for example, that Hitler himself ever attended this Thule Society, and in fact, he actually moved to suppress it several times. But it was definitely real, and it did exert some influence on at least some of the Nazi leaders. Anyway, let's cut right to von Däniken at this point and then work backwards from there to the finish. After all, as we saw Phil Kaufman admitting to Larry Kasdan, it was basically his doctor, von Däniken, and the Bible and nothing else. Von Däniken, in other words.
Yeah.
One of the main sources that's listed in the back of Chariots of the Gods is a 1960 book called Departure into the Third Millennium. I won't even attempt the title in German, of course.
Okay, so it, yeah.
It was published by a French science fiction publisher, but it claimed to be nonfiction. Again, 1960. The English version of the book is known as The Morning of the Magicians. And this book contains practically every single idea that made it into Chariots of the Gods. It has the supposedly inexplicable Perry Reese map, the Nazca lines, the Iron Pillar of Delhi, E.T. building the Great Pyramid, everything. And, of course, the Ark of the Covenant. So, to put it shortly, von Däniken essentially cribbed his entire bestseller from The Morning of the Magicians. And this shouldn't be too big a surprise because von Däniken was a con man. I mean, literally a con man. He did time in Swiss prisons on two different occasions for fraud, embezzlement, and forgery.
Man.
in fact, he stole the money that he used to research the book and then paid it back later after Chariots of the Gods was a hit in order to avoid more jail time.
Man, man.
Apparently, he wasn't a very good writer either. The original version of Chariots of the Gods was so badly done that he couldn't get it published. The German publisher who did finally take a chance on it insisted that it be completely reworked by a professional author. So, von Däniken hired a guy named Wilhelm Utz Untermann, who, under the pseudonym of Wilhelm Rogersdorf, rewrote the prose in the book, and he also added more material from Morning of the Magicians. Why did Untermann use a pseudonym? Well, the reason for that is pretty interesting. It's because,
to say the least,
back in the 40s, he used to be one of the main editors at the Folk Nationalist Observer. Yes, the official news outlet of the Nazi Party, working for Dr. Goebbels, in other words.
Yeah.
And don't forget, the Folk Nationalist Observer started out as the official newspaper of the Thule Society. And Untermann was also happened to be the chief editor of Hitler Youth material published during the same period.
Yes.
This is the guy who actually wrote Chariots of the Gods. Excuse me. Well, when von Däniken wrote the sequel to Chariots of the Gods in 1972, called Gods from Outer Space, after the craze had already took off, he decided not to use Untermann again. He decided instead to bring in a NASA design engineer instead to give the book some extra credibility. So he picked a guy by the name of Joseph F. Blumrich, and he too was a former Nazi.
Our Germans were better than their Germans.
Yes, he was one of the dozens of Nazis that NASA brought over from Germany after the war to work on the space program.
Yeah.
In fact, he was one of the main designers of the Saturn V moon rocket and also Skylab. So, well, okay, one last question. Where did the French authors of Morning of the Magicians get their ideas?
We trace the rabbit trail even further into the past here. Yes.
Remember, this is the book that first made the switch from lost Egyptian super science to UFOs taught their science to the Egyptians. It's a key moment. Okay. Well, believe it or not, they got their ideas from legendary New England horror writer H.P. Lovecraft. We know this for a fact, and I'll show you how we know. The publishers of Morning of the Magicians were Lovecraft's official publishers in France. They popularized him through their magazine, Planète, and it started a major fad, in fact. And they also published many other of the Cthulhu mythos writers also. Morning of the Magicians was published at this time in order to cash in on the French Lovecraft craze. and to tease readers that were already interested in ancient astronauts with the idea that they might really have existed. Lovecraft, in fact, is explicitly credited in the book with suggesting the idea to the authors. As far as we can tell, the very first book ever to propose the gods from outer space idea, ancient astronauts, was H.P. Lovecraft's 1926 book, The Call of Cthulhu. And he followed it up a few years later with another book called At the Mountains of Madness. Both of these have this idea. Really, the whole genius or innovation of Lovecraft was the way that he recast Edgar Allan Poe-like supernatural stories in materialist terms. Lovecraft was an atheist, a pretty aggressive materialist. In Lovecraft stories, all of the demons and ghosts or things are really aliens, etc. Not in every single story, but that was one of Lovecraft's big innovations. But a lot of Von Däniken's case really does just parallel Lovecraft perfectly. For example, Lovecraft is explicitly in 1926 attributed the Easter Island statues to his old ones. You know, the aliens who came to Earth in ancient times before the humans existed. So,
yeah.
And in fact, there are several passages in Chariots of the Gods that even echo Lovecraft's wording a little bit. Also, Morning of the Magicians also has the Spear of Destiny stuff in it too, but more on that next week.
Yeah.
So, there we go. Would you ever have believed that we came this close to getting a cheesy 70s In Search Of version of Raiders of the Lost Ark? With these kind of deep roots in anti-Semitism, occultism, and even Nazism.
Even outright Nazism, yeah.
In this version, it's not the Nazis going after the biblical ark. It's Indiana Jones going after the Nazi ark.
Man, that's crazy.
Is that crazy?
That's where we're at here.
Is that crazy or what?
Man.
And it's also ironic because poor Phil Kaufman may be the most Jewish of all the three Jews that came up with Raiders.
Yeah, Spielberg, Kasdan.
And Kaufman.
We're all Jewish, yeah.
Phil Kaufman actually lived on a kibbutz in Israel for a while in the 60s.
Man.
But he just picked it up from Von Däniken, just uncritically, like the rest of the world did during the craze for that book.
Yeah.
Myself included, I read Chariots of the Gods and thought it was a cool, funky idea. Yeah. Got a little obsessed with it for a while. So I can definitely relate. But I didn't dig too deep trying to figure out where it all came from.
Yeah.
Now here, this is interesting. The first two drafts of the script that Kasdan wrote have the electrical arc. Okay.
Really?
Yes.
This is just...
The first draft, dated June 15th, 1978, has the Belloc character, although he's still called Lovar in this version instead of Belloc. Here's one of his lines. Have you read the Bible? Have you seen how the ark was constructed? Do you know what that means? It's a transmitter, a radio for talking to God. Now, we're all familiar with some version of that line, but it kind of takes on a new light now, doesn't it?
For sure.
In this draft, the opening of the ark is described entirely in terms of electricity. Lightning bolts, discharges, people getting quote-unquote fried. The ark, in this version, sets the tents, the submarine fuel, and the munitions on fire. And Indy and Marion load the ark onto a mine cart while the Nazis try to put out the fire. And then we get the mine car chase from Temple of Doom.
That shows up in Temple of Doom a few years later. Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
Originally, that mine car chase was a way for the heroes to escape with the ark out of this underground base, like James Bond getting out of the villain's lair in You Only Live Twice while it blows up around the...
Sure, yeah.
The 007 influence is still here pretty strong.
Yeah.
But in the first draft, there's no sand in the ark. There's no melting Nazis.
No.
No ghosts.
Certainly no ghosts.
Much less any
death.
Angels. Yeah. Nothing about don't look at it, Marion. Keep your eyes closed.
Nothing
none of
yet.
That's here.
Even up until the second draft.
In the second draft, which is dated a full year later, August 3rd, 1979, Larry Kasdan went off the project for a while to write Empire Strikes Back. And when he came back and wrote the second draft, the Ark still releases
some
kind of ambiguous electrical force. The only difference in this version, and this in itself is a little bit significant, is that the Belloc character experiences some kind of epiphany in death while he's lying on the ground, burnt up from being hit with lightning. He says, he's able to whisper out, "I've seen the face of God." But once again, still no angels, still no...
none of the rest of it.
The lid of the Ark coming back down on its own accord and closing it up again.
Yeah.
None of that stuff. So, another way of saying this is, you guys don't know how close we came to getting the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull as the first Indiana Jones movie instead of the last
one. Instead of the last
one. Or the more recent, the most recent one anyway.
The most recent one, yeah.
So, now,
incredible, definitely.
Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that gods from outer space isn't an intriguing idea. Doesn't mean I actually believe in it, of course. That's irrelevant when it comes to a story. I even like it in The Crystal Skull a little bit. And I suppose it wasn't as wacky a commercial idea as it sounds now either, because, I mean, think about it. Spielberg was just coming off of his giant hit, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is another movie based on the 70s unexplained craze.
Yep.
UFOs.
Sure. Yeah.
So, but I think most of us in here would agree that it's nowhere near as great as the wonderful mashup of Spy Smasher and the Ten Commandments that we get in the classic finished film.
Finished Raiders. Yeah.
And by the way, did you know that the gag with the Paramount logo turning into a mountain in our movie?
Gradually becoming,
that's actually taken from DeMille's 1956 Ten Commandments.
How about that? Yeah. Is it really?
It is.
How about that?
Yes, it's a direct tribute on Spielberg.
Okay, I think I do remember this.
Yes.
Yeah, how about that?
In Ten Commandments, also a Paramount release,
Fascinating.
The mountain, Paramount mountain, fades into Mount Sinai.
Mount Sinai, yeah.
So, and the Ten Commandments happens to have been Spielberg's favorite movie growing up. So,
which he said,
Now,
along with The Greatest Show on Earth, also, DeMille.
That one too, yeah. So, the question at this point is, who exactly was it and when? Who exactly got cold feet and decided to let God in after all? And thereby created this whole problem of Indy's conversion. It happened pretty late in the process and maybe without time to think it all out very well.
Pretty interesting.
That's pretty interesting. And we'll pick up that subject next week. I've titled next week's episode... and this, I'll tell you where the title comes from. William Hootkins. Who knows who William Hootkins is?
Definitely not me.
William Hootkins played the space pilot Porkins in Star Wars. And he also plays one of the government men in Raiders.
He does, in fact.
Named, Colonel Mutt. No, wait a minute. What is it? I forget what his character name is.
But he's there in the
classroom.
He's
one of the government.
He's
the guy who says top. Man, at the end.
That's him.
That's William Hootkins.
Yeah.
And William Hootkins says that right after he signed on to do the movie, he couldn't tell any of his friends what it was all about. He said, "I finally just decided to start describing it to people as the Bible with Nazis." So that
pretty good.
That'll be the title of episode 4 in this series.
Episode 3 in
the Indiana Jones series. The Bible with Nazis next week on the Popcorn Cathedral.
Awesome.
So hope you've enjoyed this talk. Hope you enjoyed all that Arcana.
That was pretty deep here.
That was fun stuff to dig up, though, because it's so nutty. It's so completely insane.
Yeah, that's...
everything you could have imagined. Yeah, you could possibly think of.
Who knew, huh?
A veritable melting pot of Lovecraft and Napoleon.
And it's all real.
Agrippa.
It's all real. Anyway, we'll talk.
Pretty crazy.
We'll talk about what the Ark really is next week.
Yes, definitely.
And we'll that should be.
This will be the cliffhanger for the more orthodox version of the movie that we ultimately get by in 1981.
That's right.
All right. So that'll probably be it for us here. Let me remind you guys again about the new Facebook group based on the Popcorn Cathedral. A great way to submit your questions, reactions, and so forth. So just just generally join our community and be part of the discussion. I'm certainly interested in what everybody's got to say after all this.
Go to Popcorn Cathedral on Facebook and send us a friend request.
Yeah, for sure. Yep. Shoot us a request and we'll be with you guys.
Okay. Until next week. So long, everybody.
See you guys. Bye.